Many of you have been following my holistic health journey with Holistic Goddess and their amazing products. I can't tell you how much it eases my mind to have a brand I can truly rely on. Everything is crafted with care and aligns perfectly with my wellness values. I have to share my latest obsession, castor oil by Queen of the Thrones. I've been learning so much about clean and natural health and the importance of using quality products. This one is a total game changer. What I love about Queen of Thrones castor oil is that it's 100% pure, hexane-free, and extra virgin, all packed in a glass bottle. It's thoroughly sourced and third-party tested, so I know I can trust what I'm putting on my body. The organic golden castor oil is incredibly versatile. I use it to regenerate my skin for a firmer look and reduce the appearance of fine lines, wrinkles, and crow's feet. It also supports my hair's appearance, helping hair look stronger and adds shine while being deeply hydrating for my scalp. Plus, it works wonders as a natural makeup remover and moisturizer. It truly covers all bases. It even pairs beautifully with the original castor oil pack for full body wellness. If you're looking to elevate your wellness routine like I have, I highly recommend checking out Queen of Thrones Organic Golden Castor Oil on the Holistic Goddess website. It's been a fantastic addition to my self-care, and it might just be what you need too. For more info, visit holisticgoddess.com and discover how castor oil can support your wellness journey today. Use my code UNDERSTOOD for a special discount of 15% off. Welcome back to Misunderstood, everybody. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Today, we are so excited to introduce Bob Forrest, a musician, addiction counselor, and well-known advocate for recovery. Many might recognize Bob as the lead vocalist of Thelonious Monster, or from his role as a counselor on Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. For those of you who don't know, which would be sort of crazy, but I was on Celebrity Rehab season 4, which I think is out and available for you to listen to on Amazon Prime. If you haven't seen it, you should. It was honestly, I mean, I don't even know why I'm telling you this, but it was one of the best times I've ever had. I made really close friendships, which I still have now. And I felt like I got help that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. It was a real recovery place. I mean, there was nothing staged. I know people say that reality TV is not real. It absolutely was the most real 3 weeks I've ever had. And I went on to go live with, I think, 4 or 5 of these guys afterwards. Unfortunately, out of the 8 of us, 2 have died since from drug addiction. So, I mean, it's a terrible statistic there. Anyways, I met Bob Forrest there. He was an addiction counselor there. He was in a lot of my group meetings. I became very close to Bob and I saw him for counseling after I left the show. It's an honor to know him and be friends with him, quite frankly. But beyond the music and the TV appearances, Bob has become a powerful voice in addiction treatment, using his own journey from rock and roll excess to sobriety to help countless others find their way to recovery. He's here with us today to talk about his latest project, DNA for Addiction, a groundbreaking approach to understanding the genetic factors of addiction. We'll dive into what DNA for Addiction is all about, how it could change the way we approach treatment, and of course, learn more about Bob's incredible journey and passion for helping others. Please enjoy my conversation with my friend, Bob Forrest. Bob Forrest, it is such a pleasure to see you again. I haven't seen you in ages.
It's been years.
So a lot of people might not know this, but I was on Celebrity Rehab season 4, I believe it was. And you, I mean, you were a big hero to me then, but that's when I met you. This was in, I think it was 2010. So quite a while ago, but we basically spent 3 weeks together.
Yeah, it was the greatest. And I remember, and I see people when they're pulled back and forth, and you were pulled back and forth, like everybody's telling you not to do it, but you want to do it to speak your truth, but you can't speak your truth. And it's just like the chaos. I remember it was so hard for you to be there because you're being torn. And so many people in treatment are like that, not under your circumstances, but, you know, they want to get back to their kids or their because other people want them to be there, but they don't really want to be there. And that you were a great definition of so many people that are in treatment that are torn about being there. right? Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was being torn because my lawyer at the time was like, oh, we can't have you on the show because it violates your NDA.
Is there any lawyer? Is there any lawyer that wants somebody on Celebrity Rehab?
Right, right, of course. But, you know, here's the thing. I was there for Love Addiction. And I will say, we had 80 pages of a whole thing that VH1 had to sign saying that we wouldn't talk about the obvious elephant in the room. Yeah. But I had major things that I could deal with, which was the loss of my father and the loss of my fiance on September 11th. My father died from a cocaine overdose when I was 15 and he was 44. And that's what I dealt with on the show and what it was like to have Love Addiction. I remember when I went in with Drew, sitting there the night before you guys started filming. It was, I guess, on a Sunday or something. And I was like, there's no way I'm doing this. But when I sat down with him, and you may have even been there that night, I can't remember, but I was like, oh, I need this. Like, I didn't believe in Love Addiction. I didn't know what it was, but I was like, oh, I need to go to this because I was so lost. And people always talk about how reality shows are not real. To me, that was the most real 3 weeks that I've ever experienced. I mean, I got so much help. I really bonded with that group, even though we kind of hated each other at the time. Remember me and Janice and how I left?
And I left Jason, the house. And Jason.
And Jason.
Sadly.
Yeah, sadly. Yeah, and that's the other thing. We had 8 people in the house and 2 people out of the 8 have since died from drug addictions, which is incredibly sad. And then from all your episodes, I mean, how many do you think at this point have
died? I think it's 7 have died. And what's sad is we keep telling people addicts die. This is a deadly disease. Then when they do, the public blames Dr. Drew. It's just like there's this transference of anger towards addicts, and it's still going on to this day. I deal with it all the time. And the newest thing is prescription drug mom addicts. Like they're this, the devil, and it's almost like the Salem witch trials against mothers. You got institutional things like DCFS and child services. It's okay for dads to be addicts, but it's not okay for moms to be addicts. It's just unbelievable how hypocritical our society is.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's true. I see it all the time in New York City. I mean, I live in Florida now, but it was like always, you know, the talk about who was on pills, you know, and if they were, you know,
fit or unfit.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
But they never ask if the dads are fit or unfit.
Right. Well, that's true. But wait, to go back to one thing about Celebrity Rehab, I just want to say it's interesting because people, you're right, would later on get a quote or have Dr. Drew on their show to talk about it. And it would kind of almost blame the show. And I want to actually say something because I wasn't there, obviously, for a quote unquote substance abuse issue.
Yeah.
But everyone else was. I mean, from heroin to, you know, to benzos to whatever it was, right? And I witnessed these people who, yes, got paid because they were celebrities, but that to me is something that people need to stop and think about for a second. Who gives a shit what took them to get into treatment for those 3 weeks? Because they stopped what they were doing. They were in a place where they were like going down a path that was really dangerous. And for those 3 weeks, they were given the opportunity to figure it out, to clean it up, to get better, to change their path. If they chose not to once they left, that's on them. But I can attest to when I was there and the people that I've become friends with from seasons before and after, that was a moment in time where they were really getting help. And I want people to know that it was more than a show. And even though the celebrities got paid to be there, they were getting clean for those 3 weeks. So everyone should appreciate that. And they got the actual tools to use to go forward.
And access to information. So I'm doing this new idea, which is DNA for addiction. Everybody says, well, what is it? And you want specificity and definition. And I say, it's just another tool. Mm. It's another tool that you can have. We are too much of a society that wants doctors to fix us, other people to fix us, rather than you get tools and information and you fix yourself. Mm. That's just not an American tradition anymore. It's more like, give me a pill, tell me, give me a guru book, give me a podcast on CrossFit, do all these things, and outside sources fix me. Right. Rather than we know that you're the only one that has the motivation, the connectivity to fix yourself. But right. when I was reading about your podcast, I'm so congratulations. It's so, I was telling you before air, like I get so many people ask me how to do a podcast or what to do. I've had a podcast since before they were called podcasts, but I don't, not really. I just want to get the message out about overdose death and music and life and yeah. have my small little following, but it survived for 10, 12 years or something in different amalgamations. But people want to have a podcast and then they think you're just going to become Marc Maron. You know what I mean? No, yeah. it's hard work. You have to have a great concept and you need to know how to talk. Right. And I think the one thing why podcasts are so popular is people don't converse anymore. So then thus people don't know how to talk. Yeah. I was at the bank the other day and a bunch of millennials and Xers and Zers or whatever they are. And then there was this old couple behind me and I didn't have my phone and they look like they didn't have phones. And everyone else in the bank, including some of the people that work there, are all on their phones. And we all made an old people joke, like, what would they do if they didn't have their phones?
Right.
Well, they'd be talking. And it was a long line at the bank. And the three of us talked for like 15, 20 minutes just about grandkids. And, they were sad that their daughter had moved to Texas and the grandkids are far away now and from California. Just people don't do that anymore. They're all glued to their phones, so they don't know how to talk. So for some reason, what's podcasts? They're just conversations, and people right. are eavesdropping on conversations because they don't have them and society doesn't, everybody's on their phones.
Right. Like a fly on the wall.
Gathering useless information.
Right. Well, I want to talk about something you brought up. This thing of DNA for addiction.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what that is? Because it was very interesting.
Well, I tell the story. When I went to Hazelden, my first rehab in 1987, I walked in the door. I paid $14,000 of my own hard-earned money. Well, not so hard-earned. I was a singer. It wasn't that hard-earned. But I went there. And I'm thinking, and I'm getting attaboys from all my friends and the people that did the intervention on me, and I'm going to rehab, and I get there, and as soon as I walk in the door, they tell you, you've got a disease, you're going to die, and I'm like, whoa, 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 everybody is so happy at the airport, now you're coming at me. And so as the first week rolled around, it was the first time I was introduced to the disease concept. And they kept saying I have a genetic basis for it. So, I'm a smart aleck and an entitled prince, and I said to my counselor, like, I want to take this genetic test. If you're saying I have a genetic disease, I want to see it. Yeah, predisposition. Yeah. And immediately they did what they always do in rehab, which is blame the patient. So they said, well, see, that's your disease. That's denial. And I was like, whoa, you're telling me, I walked in here, you're telling me I have a disease that it's genetically based and that I'm going to die of it. Shouldn't I be tested for it?
Right.
And they actually didn't have a test. It was just a theory.
Right.
So then over time, I've been kind of obsessed with, what is the genetic test? And Dr. Drew talked about it when we were on the show.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a genetic markers done by UCLA, but to test for it was so expensive and it is kind of vague. It's not a genetic marker that says you're going to love OxyContin. It's more nuanced than that. It's the sensitivity to light and sound. It's attunement to environment. And it's more in the emotional part of the makeup of a person. So
right.
why is that the area where you see consistent patterns of positivity in addicts? Why is that? Well, if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. So what do you hear? What did you hear from Jason and all the people on Celebrity Rehab? When they had their first drink or they took their first pill, they felt so perfect. They felt like how everyone else, they thought everyone else felt, right? Well,
right.
if you're hypersensitive to people's moods and the environment and sounds, when you numb that for the first time, you're going to feel relief from the intensity, noise, cacophony of life. And so when I found that out from Dr. Drew and the doctor who kind of discovered the theory of it, it made perfect sense to me. I just never felt right. Well, why did I never feel right? Because I can look at somebody's face and know they're in a bad mood in 2 seconds. I don't even have to look at them. I can sense them in my in my central nervous system that something's wrong. If you hear a loud sound, you're highly attuned and wanting to suss it out. So it's a survival mechanism that we no longer need. We're not being eaten by wild animals and we're not being killed by Huns. So why does this exist? It's a survival mechanism. We would have been the great survivors 1,000 years ago, you know, but now with air conditioning and cars and trucks and safety, you don't really need it. And so that's what the marker is. It tells you if you have that hypersensitivity to environment. It doesn't mean you're going to be a drug.
Have you listened to the podcast Uncomfy, sticking with moments that challenge us? Real stories from guests who dared to get uncomfortable in a moment that challenged their worldview. In the thick of intense emotions, they chose to stay curious and open rather than lash out or shy away, and came out the other side with stronger relationships, clearer beliefs, and increased confidence. And you can do it too. Part real life stories, part conflict coaching, and self-improvement. So if you want to engage with others on important topics but aren't sure how, or are burnt out on social media and wish you could bring the humanity back into discussions online or real life, look no further. Learn how to improve your communication, disagree more productively, and be an inspired leader. In such a polarized world, learning how to stick with moments that challenge us without getting defensive or shutting down is a direct antidote for division. When you listen to this podcast, you will hear how others are healing their communities, families, and neighborhoods, learning to talk about what matters to them, working to view others as human so we can build a better world together. Each episode models the mental health principles of MBSR, that's mindfulness-based stress reduction, non-judging, patience, beginner's mind, trust, non-striving, acceptance, letting go. Recent stories include disrespected at the pool, she decided to confront the culprits, when one word threatened a work partnership, as a kid in Iran, she was taught to hate Jews, then she defended one in court. He thought his comment was harmless, then he got written up. If you're interested in any of this, take a listen to Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us, a podcast. Right. So that's what I want to talk about. Because first of all, people that are not so familiar with drug addiction or like the terminology, right, that we all are. But talk about the concept of it being a disease and the fact that there is a way to identify genetic predispositions to addiction, as opposed to someone thinking, well, you know, I know my cousin's addiction started because he lost his child and that threw him over the edge. Right. And it was just something that happened that made him decide to numb his life. Talk about the difference.
Well, there's 4 major contributors, right? You have to have the basis for it. And what does this mean? This means you're willing to go all the way. That's all it really means. You're willing to be me or Anthony Kiedis or Jason Davis. You're willing, if you have this genetic basis and the other 3 ingredients come in place, you are willing to go all the way. That's what people can't understand about addicts. Why don't they stop? They lost their family. They lost their job. Why don't they stop? They can't stop. It's a small part of the percentage of the population, 3-10%, depending on who you believe. Once they get to that stage, that late stage, they can't stop. And so the 4 ingredients are genetic predisposition, childhood trauma, which if you're American, we all have it. The 3rd is exposure, meaning take drugs. So we're America, we all take drugs. So the 2nd and 3rd, every American probably experiences. Mm-hmm. The 4th is the most important one. And you'll see this in Seth Binzer and Jeff Conaway and myself and everyone else who's become labeled an addict, is the use of drugs in the face of adverse consequences and repeatedly doing that. Mm-hmm. And these are now that has narrowed it down to a precious few, right? So we all have people in our lives that just wouldn't stop. Your dad just wouldn't stop, maybe. He would promise. Here's the thing about addicts. When they're promising to stop, you can give them a lie detector test. They believe it, but they just can't.
Right.
And so outside of a spiritual awakening, outside of a a meeting of somebody who you trust. All these.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. When you get to that point, what is it? Because they all talk about hitting a rock bottom, and that sometimes changes your mind. But is it only that? I mean, is there a certain type of treatment you really have to get, like ketamine? And we're going to get into what happened with Matthew Perry. But you know, what will it take when someone is that far gone?
My belief, this is just my belief, is you have to meet the person. So there's a theory in Buddhism that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Right. I believe we have to meet. That's why AA is so good. That's why rehabs are so good. You have to keep going out there to find the messenger that can convey the message to you, right? I found that in a 75-year-old woman from Venice, California. She was this old hippie woman. Everyone had tried to talk to me, rock stars and all these people and the greatest therapists in LA. And I'd be like, I don't want to talk to these people. And I saw this woman. I remember so clearly it was Saturday afternoon, like at 4 o'clock at a little AA meeting on Vine Street in Santa Monica Boulevard. And I walked in. It was just a handful of people that I knew. It was a private AA weirdly in LA. And this woman, from the moment I saw her, I was like, what the hell is with that lady? And I heard her laugh. I heard her laugh, and she just was alive, and she was just free of whatever it is that I wasn't free of. Her name was Gloria Scott, and she was a drug counselor, and she helped me and gave me insight about myself, and she stuck with me from that point to when I got sober is about 4 years. And she always had she always knew what to do, either hug me or tell me I was an asshole. She always had the magical thing. Like, she knew when I was too down to call me an asshole, and she'd say, come here, I love you so much. And then other times when I was arrogant, she would say, kind of fucking father are you? You know what I mean? She just would never stop. And so I've modeled after her. She passed away in 2005, but I've modeled after her. And I think there are thousands and thousands and thousands of people like her. And every addict's got to find that person. I've luckily been that person for quite a few addicts in it.
I was going to say, you are that person for many people, but actually, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your story, how drugs play such a role for you?
Yeah, you don't want to watch a video. So I was born and raised like a spoiled child, kind of like in upper middle class or whatever. We didn't have classes back when I was a kid in the 60s. We were just pretty well-to-do. My dad had an airplane, and it's just like, and we went back and forth between Palm Springs and LA, and my dad had a supermarket chain called Thrifty Mart. And so I was the original spoiled child. I have three older sisters, and then along came me, and my dad always wanted a son. And so, you know, I was raised to be a petulant rock star. Like, you know what I mean? It was just like, it fit perfect. When the job came up to be a singer in a band, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then I could just continue acting in this kind of selfish, but I always had this caring character, this caring soul in me, but I was spoiled. And then I became a musician. And so nobody could talk to me. Nobody could steer me right. And I kind of was my own worst enemy, and I made a bunch of records. I came up in the 80s with the Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction in LA. But I was profoundly addicted to alcohol at probably, I don't know, 19. I mean, I was a morning drinker in college, and I didn't see anything wrong with it.
I used to just go with whatever meat looked good or was on sale at the grocery store. But now that I've experienced the exceptional quality, flavor, and convenience that you can get from Omaha Steaks, I'm never going back. They can build a custom food plan based on your schedule, which means less food waste and stocking up on high-quality proteins to always have on hand. With Omaha Steaks in your freezer, you're always just minutes away from a quality dinner, whether it's Taco Tuesday or a weekend feast. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference and never settle for grocery proteins again. Get flavorful, high-quality proteins delivered by visiting omahasteaks.com, plus $35 off when you use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code YUM. Terms apply. See site for details. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code YUM at checkout for $35 off. Minimum purchase may apply.
right?
But like, were you able to function even though you were drinking all the time?
Astonishingly so. There was a famous producer named Tony Berg. His daughter now is a very successful musician. I was doing demos over at his house, and apparently, you know, I was just drinking beer and recording with this engineer and Tony, and I was just drinking and doing a little coke and smoking a little heroin. I was there all day. And then the next day, his daughter and he cleaned up the studio, and they counted 30 Budweiser cans that I had drank in one day. And Tony was like, didn't even seem like he was drunk. Like, how can there be so many beer cans? But you build up a tolerance, and I'd been drinking from a pretty early age. And then when I got introduced to stimulants, that kind of rights you. And then heroin was the final frontier back then. Now it's the drug of the exposure drug nowadays with the prescription opioids. But we were always kind of scared of heroin, my gang. And then finally, once we did it, probably in 83 or 84, it took over our lives. And I always say, why was I able to make 5 albums and tour all over the world for 6 or 7 years? Because heroin came way later in my life. Hmm. I know that sounds ridiculous, but you can drink and do coke and kind of get through a day.
Right.
Once heroin comes into your life, you ain't doing nothing. You ain't going nowhere. You can barely get out of bed, barely get out of the house. It's opioids are such a corrosive, destructive drug. And look at America. We are 5% of the world's population. We consume 80% of the world's opioids.
Yeah.
Astonishing.
Well, yeah, it is astonishing. Let's talk about some of the facts, because this opioid crisis, I mean, in this political climate, it seems to be a major crisis, but it's been a crisis for decades.
Well, I
would
say, is
decades.
It a crisis, or do we just accept it as the norm now? We keep using the word crisis. We don't do anything about it. 122,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2023. Right. If 122,000 people died of anything, it would be the top priority to stop. This is the stigma of addiction. They do it to themselves, or right. It's accidental. The Matthew Perry stuff. I'm shocked by the Matthew Perry stuff, but I shouldn't be. I see it all the time. Every time a celebrity dies, Tom Sizemore passed away last year, and it was the same thing. It's like, how could this happen? And trying to find who's to blame. Like, it's been going on for 20 years. It's like a slow car chase, you know, like.
With the Matthew Perry thing, I mean, it seems, you know, it highlights the ongoing struggles, even after years of sobriety, of how many people. I mean, he wrote a book. He had just come out with a book talking about getting sober after all these years, and was clearly hiding it still. So, I mean, it just shows you how hard it is.
Let's talk about the hiding it. Like, what else are they supposed to do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
At a certain point, when you've declared yourself or you've been labeled an addict and you've gone to treatment and you're in the public, you're going to lie. You know what I mean? When you have a difficult time, there's very few people that will just say, yep, I screwed up again.
But Bob, you know, don't you agree? You don't have to be in the public eye. It could be within your family. You've said, yes. Okay. You spent all this money on rehab. I'm better. And then you're embarrassed or shamed to say that it's happening again.
That's what I'm saying. Everybody knows that you're labeling yourself an addict and you sought treatment and now you've screwed up. We're not a very forgiving society. And I think addicts feel that at their core, right?
I want to talk about some of the numbers, though. Like the overdose deaths, you said was 122,000. I had, around then. Opioids were involved in 75% of those deaths. And then explain what an opioid is.
So opioids are, it used to be derivative of poppies and you know, heroin, the typical prescription drugs, Norcos, Vicodins, that they don't really have anymore. Then it became OxyContin, and now it's illicit fentanyl. Fentanyl is not really classed. Fentanyl's in a class of its own. It's 50 times stronger than most opioids. Most opioids are opiate-based and morphine-based, and fentanyl is not. It's all man-made chemicals.
Right.
So fentanyl is probably a contributor of half those deaths.
Well, I have it right here. Fentanyl is 70% of overdoses.
There you go.
And prescription opioids are 30%.
And going down because there's not a lot of prescription opioids available.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So fentanyl has taken over. I told Drew this like 10 years ago, or I don't even, maybe longer. I was reading a New Yorker article about this Chinese middle manager of fentanyl distribution. This before we were aware of it. And you could order $4,000 worth of fentanyl from a Chinese factory. And this is got the middleman. It would be delivered by Amazon to your door. This is before all the awareness about fentanyl. $4,000 would make $10 million worth of product on the street. And when I saw the, I read the paragraph like four times, $4,000 investment, $10 million. I was like, oh my God. And I told you this, like, oh my God, there's a drug. I don't know what it is, but for $4,000, you can make $10 million worth of product.
Yeah.
That's what you're seeing. It's so inexpensive. It replaces heroin on the market. It replaces OxyContin on the market. It replaces everything on the market. It blocks out the sun in the profits that it makes. Right. So all the cartels in Mexico, that's what they're providing is fentanyl.
And explain to me why the average everyday person isn't scared of this recreational use of cocaine or whatever, which is laced with fentanyl. I mean, you could not be an addict. You can try it once and that can be the time you die, which is
especially
terrifying.
Kids. Well, the reason why, I mean, I like the absolute truth, no matter how ugly it is. We're a society that thinks pills are safe. Mm. The medical profession, the pharmaceutical industry have not done a good enough job to tell Americans, hey, there's a sheet that comes in the box that tells you all the side effects that could happen to you. Right. You know, they make it so small you can't read it. But at the end of a commercial for a prescription drug, it'll say could cause sterilization, vomiting, or death. No one listens to that. That means it's dangerous.
Right.
That means even Lexapro used incorrectly, even aspirin can be dangerous.
Things that you have in your medicine cabinet
are dangerous.
Right now. Yeah. And especially when you mix them. Right. I mean, up until years, I mean, now it's like a one take. You can just take fentanyl or cocaine and you're done.
But I'm going to tell you why people take it and die is because we make it seem like these dangerous drugs, when misused, are safe. And so our children believe they're safe. Even though we have childproof caps on everything, that means a child, if he gets it, could die.
Right.
It's dangerous. Drugs are dangerous.
But it's no longer just about mixing, you know, doing the uppers during the day. And for ADHD, let's say you have it in your prescription cabinet. And then at night, you're taking the Ambien to go to sleep. And then you're mixing it with alcohol. I mean, explain the dangers of mixing, too.
Well, I just want to get really across this point. So kids believe that pills are safe. Mm-hmm. We have not done a good job enough of saying how dangerous prescription drugs are. Even when you get them from a doctor, even for good reason, they are dangerous.
Right.
So when kids go to a party and they see a pill rather than a powder or a joint, right? We've demonized a lot of drugs and drug users. So they're scared of powders, scared of pot, but they're not scared of pills. So they ingest a pill that they're told is okay, that the person who's having the party, that it's Xanax. It's not Xanax. It's fentanyl-laced Xanax. And they die. You see this time and time again of 14, 15-year-old girls in particular. I live in Claremont, California. That's like Mayberry RFD. There's been four deaths here in a year of little kids because they think that pill is safe. Well, okay, well, I went to a party and a pill is safe. So I've got this message out all wherever I go. Like, pills are not safe. They're not.
How do we talk to kids about, you know, I remember when we were younger, we would see those public service announcement commercials on TV. And it's like, this is your brain. This is your brain.
Yeah, it's kind of dramatic.
Yeah. But, you know, my daughter's 12. I know she came home last year in sixth grade and said she had seen two kids in her class vaping in the bathroom, which is crazy. And it's kind of like, it starts so early now. How do you tell them it's not cool when they're like, mom, you're not cool? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, what is the message we give them?
Well, you have to give them pointers. I have a 13-year-old son and all his friends, and we have an adoptive son too. And all their friends, I tell them, like, you just got to have something to say, right? Because you're getting pressured. They're going to get pressured because that insecurity in adolescence, if somebody doesn't want to do something, they tend to try to come get that person to do it. It's just a built-in trait of teenagers. You have to have something to say. And all you have to say is, my mom and dad are drug addicts and I can't, I've seen what it's like. I just, please don't. You have to say something to them that will stop the pressure in its tracks, right? Mm-hmm. You can say, my dad's friend died of drugs. And I've coached my son that he can talk about Kurt Cobain or he can talk about whoever that will get the message across. My dad works in addiction. Little Peep died, Extension died, you know, Little Peep and Juice WRLD died of drugs. These are heroes to them, right?
Right.
Little Peep's the best example. The kid was like 21 years old. He was a genius musician and he was taking Xanax after Xanax on YouTube, like broadcasting live, taking drugs on YouTube, and YouTube obviously doesn't have any filter to stop that. Mm-hmm. And you know, so this idea that they have, we have to give them tools of what to say when they're being peer pressured. I really believe that.
Yeah.
Right. And so we'd be honest about it. Like, I think that we sanitize things too much for our kids. And I always say, well, what age are we going to start to tell them the truth? And I know that at I was lied to my whole life until I was 13. So disillusioning, right? It mm-hmm. turned out that my parents that I thought were my parents weren't my parents. They were my grandparents. And my middle sister was my mother.
Oh my
you
God.
Know what I mean? Like Chinatown. So all that time, I remember thinking like, who knew this? So, and I would go back in my memory of conversations about this with either my sisters or family or my aunt. They all knew. So they were all lying to me my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a big proponent of like, tell your kids the truth that they could handle in the moment. I have an 8-year-old. She knows about drugs. She doesn't know the extent that the 13-year-old does, but she knows about it.
Right.
Like, and her new thing is I'm introducing her to music all the time. And last night she wanted to hear punk rock and the Sex Pistols, and we were playing the Sex Pistols. And she said, she knew. She goes, did one of these guys die of drugs? And I was like, yeah. They did. Sid Vicious did. But so to make our kids aware that drugs are dangerous, you can live a full and happy and fun, free, carefree life without doing them. That's mm-hmm. another important thing. I think sobriety looks kind of boring to teenagers, right?
Yeah.
I ain't boring. To me, AA says, this is a bridge back to the real world. What does that mean? Go live your life, you know? Don't just sit in an AA meeting talking about 20 years ago. Go live and seize the day.
Well, and let's talk for a second then about the going back to the DNA for addiction and the genetic mm-hmm. predisposition. So what is it that you guys are offering now? You guys can get a kit now, right?
At home, it comes to your house. You swab it in your mouth, put it in. It's all anonymous. It's just numbers. The insurance industry can't know about it. And you can get a results back via email anonymously. That's very important to everybody. They don't want to be labeled an addict. We're like Apple. We're not going to let anybody know who you are. We don't even know who you are, but we'll get you the information back to you that, is low to moderate is kind of how we're looking at it. Because we don't want the labeling to be, oh my God, this person's an addict. No, there's many more components to come. This is just a tool to say, hey, you know, if you're playing soccer and you break your arm,
Tell them
you don't need OxyContin. You know what I mean?
Right.
I've dealt with some addicts. That, you know, it's been a long time since I've seen you. I've had women come to my Malibu treatment center that were prescribed OxyContin for PMS. How the hell is that possible?
Yeah. I mean,
it's, you know, in America, anything is possible.
Well, listen, I mean, I've been to doctors where you can tell them what you want.
Yeah, there you go. Work.
And they're just like, okay, no problem, because they're getting their $300 or $450 an hour, and that's what they're there for. So that's what, you know, makes it difficult.
That's what the Matthew Perry doctors didn't realize. They seem like, you know, they're kind of like the Keystone Cops. I don't think they'd ever dealt with such a complicated person as Matthew Perry and such a celebrity as him and this unlimited resources.
Well, they got disillusioned with the amount of money they were getting, right? And they were making so much money, and they didn't see, wait a minute, he's a real addict. This could be a problem. Or we're giving this to his assistant, and who knows how they're going to treat it, and we can get in trouble for this later.
I think they realized he's not a cooperative patient. Remember, Drew always said the one thing you know about addicts is they're not going to cooperate.
Yeah.
So he's saying, you know, hey, I'm Matthew Perry. I just want to try your ketamine. Can you give me a drip? And then he's got them on a hook and he's not going to let them go.
Right.
As soon as they sold him the first vial, he had them and he was going to ride them. And so their resentment, I studied the whole like thing as much information as there is. When that doctor makes that statement, I wonder how much this moron will pay for a vial. That's resentment. That doctor is resenting Matthew Perry. Why? Because he's done something immoral. He stepped over a line and now he can't get out of it. And now greed takes over. Okay, well, I can do this because he's going to pay $1,000 a vial more than they're worth.
Right.
And I love that they call Matthew Perry a moron. Who's the moron now? For whatever money they made, 50 grand, they're going to lose their medical licenses, might lose their freedom. And this happens every time doctors interface with addicts, real addicts like Matthew Perry.
Well,
you know what
like
I mean?
Michael Jackson, remember?
Michael Jackson, I mean, Conrad
very
Murray.
Very similar.
Conrad Murray, that story goes, he was there, so he was trying to resuscitate him. And, you know, and then next thing you know, the paramedics are there, and next thing you know, the cops are there. So Conrad Murray is just standing there like, What? You're a doctor? Right. What? Right. You know what I mean?
And he sold his soul for whatever it was, $150,000 a month and access to Michael Jackson and this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, was it worth it? No, he lost his freedom, his license, and everything that you're talking about.
Well, there's so many doctors doing this. You just mentioned anyway, they'll just prescribe anything they want, which is fine to you. You're not an addict. You're not a drug addict. It's
I bet you, and I haven't taken your test, and I'm curious too. I would think that I'm predisposed to it because of my father and his addiction. He was when he was younger, was against drugs, but obviously it took over. That when he was 44, he had snorted so much cocaine that he didn't have a septum in his nose.
Yeah.
There's a level there to not being able to stop.
That's kind of a New York City tradition, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
So many friends, they've had that surgery where they put a like a plastic septum in. Do you know that?
Yeah. But it's terrifying. I want to go back to ketamine for 1 second. Do you believe that ketamine has good effects?
Oh, it's a great drug.
I had someone on saying that it treats addiction if used correctly.
No, I don't know. That's misused. But so I'm a part of Wounded Warriors is a very complicated organization. It's just like kind of like AA. There's like all these different groups and they kind of do their own thing. But I'm very involved with One Wounded Warriors program. They use our property in Malibu. It's just a great organization. And they started a pilot program of it about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Great success. Like there'd be these guys that would come to the groups and they just nonverbal. They don't talk. You know, they've been through so much. They don't think any of us can relate to what they've been through. Very guarded. And we do equine therapy with them and they open up, they start talking to the horse and stuff. But I saw them take ketamine treatments and it lift their depression. It positively affect their PTSD. But when you're talking about soldiers with PTSD who are addicts, they're also very disciplined people. You know what I mean? Jason Davis and I are not disciplined people.
So when
they used it in the Wounded Warriors program on addicts, they're just a different breed of mentality of addicts. And it worked really successfully. And that's what kind of using it with the VA is what kind of opened it up to the public, as it was very successful with treating PTSD and depression in soldiers. And so thus the positive results of those kind of pilot programs is what led to it being used in a wider population. One of the things like the garden variety depression, let's call it, Freud said, and Drew loves this quote, that trying to help people understand the difference between depression and everyday misery.
Right.
So
I have that sometimes.
There is everyday misery. Like it's just crazy. Like, and people become overwhelmed by it, you know, and instead of like, hey, we're dishonest more and more about who we are, right? So everybody's life looks perfect online. And then we're comparing our our life where we're overwhelmed by laundry. I mean, I got five people in this house. The laundry, I'll just walk in the laundry room, it's just piled up to, I'm like, what the fuck? I just did this laundry. You know what I mean? My kids, I love my kids and it's my whole life, but they'll try something on and then they don't like it. And then they just go throw it in their dirty clothes hamper. Oh my God, I fold it back up and put it in the drawer. How can there be this much laundry since yesterday?
Terrible.
So you become overwhelmed. You become, you know, you just feel like you're walking uphill in mud. And I think people misunderstand that as depression. No, it's just everyday misery.
Yeah.
We all have normal. That.
Wait, I want to talk about access to treatment, because I know for me, for a lot of my friends, and I'm still friends with Jason Waller and all that, treatment is obviously a big deal. People think that when they've hit rock bottom, when they've gotten to a certain point, they need to go to rehab, but their access to it is very limited. It's very hard to either go to a good rehab, go to one they can afford, find an insurance that covers one. Like, what are your thoughts on treatment programs these days?
Well, the access is getting less and less. It was better 10 years ago. It was starting to open up. And now it's like, I just can tell you my experience as a rehab, it's really hard to operate. It's hard to keep your doors open. I felt a little guilty that I had this fancy Malibu rehab. So I opened up an affordable rehab in West LA. And it was just like an uphill battle all day long, fighting the insurance companies for their $295 a day. How can you house, feed, and counsel an addict for $295 a day in Los Angeles?
Right.
And then they deny you even that. You know, they owe you like $11,000 and they deny that payment because some I wasn't dotted or T wasn't crossed and you have to appeal it.
So it's the insurance companies that are making it difficult.
Well, I know. I don't want to blame them. We're all in this mess together. There was a lot of fraud in the recovery industry that made the insurance companies very guarded and audit and cautious, right? So hopefully we're going to get to a better place where there's access to care. My thing is you should subsidize or give tax breaks to the rehabs. If you want, you know, what do we do when we want a supermarket to come into a disenfranchised part of a community? You tax incentivize them. We need to tax incentivize rehabs open because they all close. That's another problem, is there was this gold rush of rehabs when insurance was paying and the Parity Act and Obamacare and all this. And then all the fraud, which Drew and I would talk about it. Like, it's just easier to do good treatment and make a fair amount of money than to defraud and make millions of dollars. It's just like, how much money do these people make? You know, Jason Waller knows that. He and I were a part of a rehab that in Temecula that, you know, we made a good living from for a while. And then all of a sudden you find out like, oh my God, all this money is being made by this other partner. You know, just the, once again, greed.
So wait, I have a question. I recently became friends with Bam Margera.
Yeah.
You know him?
Yes.
Obviously struggles with addiction for many years.
Yeah.
He was telling me a story. He was on my show. He's right. Come to stay with me with his wife now. We're very close.
Oh, great.
I don't know if you know him personally.
Yeah, yeah. Later.
Yeah, okay. So could benefit probably from your services. But but he talks about his resentment of rehabs because he went from treatment center to treatment center. And even when he thought he was going to get out, they were like, oh, no, this isn't working. So we're going to bill you for more and more.
And
he thought it was really terrible because he didn't feel like he got the help he needed because they were just so consumed with getting money out of him. Mm-hmm. And then whereas we look at other people that really are like, I really need rehab. I cannot do this on my own, but I don't have insurance. I can't afford it. I can't leave my life to do it.
You can't leave. Yeah. When you're living
talk about people that are listening right now that might be suffering from something and want to go look into a rehab, but don't have the access. Is there a way, is there a fund? How do people go to rehab if they really need it?
Well, first off, let's just talk about rehab. Rehab has all these arbitrary numbers, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. I think that's what BAM ran into. They want to see you hit certain treatment plan things. I think all that is in it in the ideal, if we had ideal circumstances, we most times don't. So you're going to have to meet the person where they are. They're maybe not going to hit their treatment goals. Time's a wasting, right? You have a limited amount of time. So I always do it like, let's just go piece by piece. You need to medically stabilize. You need to detox. So the opioid addicted lawyer who can't get away from work because then she won't be able to pay her mortgage and all this kind of stuff. Uh-huh. Let's just take it piecemeal. You got to detox. And we need 7 to 10 days. Right? How can we get you out of work for 7 to 10 days? Let's look at a calendar. Nobody plans rehab. I do, but most people don't because they're so concerned that the person who's using is going to die. It's not my problem. It's their problem. I want to help them to achieve sobriety and, you know, bum rushing them and pressuring them to quit their job and come to rehab, which in the instance of BAM, like you might not hit the goals. So we're pressuring you to do something that might not work. I don't like doing that. Let's talk. Let's figure it out. So you need detox. You need 7 to 10 days. Okay, Labor Day weekend's coming up. Have you got any cases on Thursday and Friday? Can you go in, you know, Wednesday night? Don't use Wednesday. Be sick. Go in Wednesday evening. And then you're going to have to take Tuesday and Wednesday off. Now you've got your 7 to 10 days. You'll be sober on Wednesday. Like that's 8 days, right? If you go 8 days without drugs, you're pretty much anybody sober. You might not be feeling all that great,
right?
But you'll be sober. And then let's get you into sober living and you can go back to work. You know, if that's what has to happen, that's what has to happen. I do it all the time, but it takes cooperation from the addict and motivation from the addict. And it takes somebody who understands the systems and doesn't let the industry, you know, overrun you and say, that's not going to work. I'm told that all the time. Bob, you're crazy. You know, I got sober in the LA County jail. They kicked me out. I walked outside. I've been sober ever since. Not everybody goes to rehab.
How long has that been?
28 years. It's ridiculous at this point.
Wow.
And so, but what did I do when I walked out? I went to AA. I called all my friends. I held on when I wanted to use. I had a lot of knowledge and experience, and I put it into action. So all those failed rehabs weren't failures. They were the tools I now have when I came out of LA County jail. Big tool was don't use no matter what. And I preach that to my short-term detox, got to get back to work crowd. Like, you're going to want to use. There's no doubt about it. You need to call me. You need to do whatever is necessary not to use. And if you do that, it will get easier.
What do you do when you want to use? Like, do you still want to use now?
I haven't wanted to use. It's like I'm, you know, knock wood, but I haven't wanted to use for a long time. But I do love addiction. Codependency is a big problem for me, right? Mm-hmm. So I started going to Al-Anon. Did you ever go?
I did.
It's such a strange world.
Yeah, it really
right?
is.
And I felt like a Martian, and I'm an addict, but I'm codependent. My wife's an addict. So I started going to Al-Anon, and they, my therapist told me to get the new inventory book at the Al-Anon meeting. And I did Al-Anon and I admitted my love addiction and codependency begrudgingly still to this day. And it's been like 10 years, but you know, when you're a junkie, it's hard to say I'm a love addict.
Yeah.
But
right.
I am,
you're like,
but
oh,
I
wow.
am, but I yeah. am. And so I go at the break to this piano where they got all the materials out at this Al-Anon meeting. And this lady's talking to somebody else, and then I'm holding the new inventory booklet, and the woman comes to me finally after she's done talking, and I said, I want to buy this, and she goes, are you on your seventh step? And I said, whoa, 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 lady, you need your codependent. Like, just give me the book. She was already butting into my business that she'd right. never seen me at the meeting, and why was I buying the seventh step booklet. the inventory right. booklet. And I find myself still to this day, I went to one a week ago. I still find myself feeling like I'm on enemy territory, but I know I belong there, right? Mm. Because I'll go nuts over my wife's problems, right? And I have this week, right? My wife, a lot of people in our lives know about it. People listen to my podcast know about it. Postpartum with women and who are addicts, everybody needs to be aware of this. There needs to be a postpartum awareness among sober women. My wife had our first child, nothing. She was like back to everything fine in like 6 weeks and no problems and nursing and fucking taking care of business. Second child during COVID was a whole different animal. And unfortunately, she relapsed over it. And it's been a wild ride for 3 years, right? To get back on track. And it's hard to, you know, when you had a stable sobriety to be new again, all this stuff. Yeah. And we've gone through it. So that's what led to my admission that I'm a love addict. Because my, when you know you're a love addict, when 90% of your thoughts are about somebody else's problems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And you can justify it. Oh, it's my wife, my kids. Whatever. No, no, no. There is a way to comport yourself and to be, to attach and love and detach. There's a way to be much better than you're justifying being, you know, getting angry, running away, all this kind of stuff. It's, I don't think we're really aware of postpartum and how profoundly it can affect people. Right. And we think it's a weakness, just like drug addiction's a weakness. Like, and I'm giving an example. I was astonished the first kid, Art Sydney, like, she was like back to work in like 6 weeks. I was like, you know, they give you 3 months off. And she's like, fuck that. And you know what I mean? But then the second time around, it just hit her. The hormones hit, whatever it was, and depression and withdrawing and not talking. We need to be much more aware of postpartum in America. We really don't. Do you agree with me? We're just not aware.
I 100%. Agree.
We think it's whiny women. It's not. I saw it. It's a real condition.
Yeah.
Right.
It's absolutely real. It affects people in all sorts of different ways. But if you have a predisposed, you know, inference to, if you're a drug addict,
yeah, it's not going to go good.
Yeah. Then you're going to go right back to it because you want to feel better. It's a terrible feeling to go through.
Right.
I want to just, we've talked about these people and yourself and people we know and, you know, all the way to Matthew Perry, that have longstanding issues with getting help, falling back into it because it's a disease. What hope can you give for people about recovery? I mean, there are people that are going to be listening that have tried and tried and tried to get off whatever they're on. What kind of hope can you give them? Do you feel like it's a mixture of things that have to do with what is predisposed and a mixture of therapeutic things or medicines? What in your
there's some opinion? Ugly truth. I think there's some ugly truths about it. Why I went to 24 treatment centers and was so incorrigible and so resistant for 9 years. You know, Dr. Drew did an intervention on me on the radio. Do you know that? I showed up to do a radio interview and I was all high. And then there was a commercial break. It was at K-Rock here in Los Angeles. And I just ran out to my car to do some crack because I was falling asleep. And I came back up and they were on the air. You know, I guess I was gone for like 20 minutes. I thought it was like 5 minutes. And I came back in and Drew's like, where'd you just go right now? We thought you left. And I was like, I just went out to my car. And he's like, what did you do in your car? You're high right now. He said this on the radio. I was incorrigible and I was talking on the radio like Matthew is like, yeah, I'm sober. I just got out of rehab.
Right. Oh my right? gosh.
So I believe that it's worth sticking around. It's worth surviving to see what happens. You know what I mean? Like you got to have some hope. I don't know what's going to happen in the addict's life, but something, and it's probably worth sticking around for. I really believe that. And, you know, where there's breath, there's hope, I always say. A lot of the most hopeless people I know are sober. Steven Adler's sober. I mean, come on, people. If you're gonna bet on addicts on celebrity rehab, who's gonna die? Steven Adler topped that list. Right. And he's alive and he's into the Four Noble Truths. Have you heard of this thing?
No.
Oh my God, he's obsessed with it. He's kind of OCD. You know, you speak with honesty with your tongue and he's all this. And he sends me these daily reflections of the Four Noble Truths. You should talk to him. He's so funny. But I mean, he
used to be my next door neighbor.
He's a hope to die craziest addict I've ever known. Yeah. I've known him for 45 years. I've known him most of my adult life. And he's alive and he's thriving.
Right.
And people that I didn't even think really had much to worry about, like Rodney King, are dead. It just makes no sense at all. So just keep on trying. Keep on trying. What else you got to do?
What else you got to do? But another quick thing is, what's your opinion on replacing one addiction with the other? So our friend Jeremy Jackson, he was on the show also. I love Jeremy, but he's really into fitness. Would you consider that like an addiction, but it's okay because it doesn't have to do with drugs? Like,
yeah, I mean, there's two ways of looking at it. That's fine. But are you going to be a fully realized self just replacing? That's what I've gone through with my codependency. Am I really going to be the person I want to be if I justify being codependent, right? Because I'm not doing heroin. So I see it with the fitness stuff a lot. It just matters, like, if you're also, I always say, you know, I got a lot of friends that go to the gym. I have this friend who's obsessed with it, Khalil. They're always at the gym and they're showing me their six packs. I'm 55 years old. Look at my stomach. I'm like, yeah, what about your brain? How long's it been since you read a book? You know what I mean? To have balance. We all want balance, right? Yeah. Balance in nutrition, balance in spirituality, balance between these two compulsions, right? To become obsessed with fitness. He was the fitness guy at me and Jason Waller's rehab.
Oh, really?
He was doing it. He had a job, like, you know what I mean? And he's very inspirational. Like, he can get a bunch of drug addicts to want to go work out. Like, not me. I'm not a workout guy, but you know, Jason was able to really motivate people in a rehab center. So I don't know that it's that bad, but are you developing other things? Are you, you know, thinking about becoming a fully realized self? And I use that word over and over again. I was kind of blind and in the dark, and I didn't really understand a lot of the things that Drew was talking about until I hit a brick wall when I was about 8 years sober, and I started going to real therapy. And I went to a real therapist, and I wanted to get better because I was in so much pain. And my therapist, Dr. Roland Kim, one of the greatest men who ever lived, I used to tell him how great he was. And he goes, I am just a garden variety psychologist. I don't know what you're talking about. But that's the thing of when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And he said to me, you want to get better or you just want to bullshit? And I was like, I want to get better. And he goes, you need to come 2 times a week. You need to pay cash one visit. And I said, why is that? And he goes, because then when people pay, they take things seriously. He wouldn't allow the second visit per week to be on insurance, which gave you longer things before you had to get another round of 24. So I'm there and I'm going, and we're going for years. I went to him for like 5 years, twice a week for about 2 years, and then once a week for about 3 years. And we're sitting there one day, and I had dealt with my mom in a way that he was coaching me to, like, attach her, tell her I loved her, but also detach and say, I gotta go. Cause my mom was a borderline and an addict, and she was difficult, very difficult person. Uh-huh. So I came back and reported back to her. I did good. You know, I got off the phone with her and she didn't threaten to kill herself. It was a good day. And he goes, oh my God, you're doing so well, Bob. You're consistently second level of insight. And I was like, and this is when I ran Los Encinas Hospital, and I'm like the king of rehab and whatever. And I was like, I just glossed over it. Like, I'm only now in the second stage of development. And I said, what stages are you talking about? And he goes, to fully realize self. And I was like, I'm on stage 2. What is that? And he goes, adolescence, you're understanding where you begin and where you end and someone else begin. You're like, you can attach and detach, but you still want to attach. So it's all the child development stages. And I said, what level are you, Roland? And he thought, you know, like when really smart people stop and think and it takes like 90 seconds, it's very uncomfortable. And he's this intellectual guy and he's just thinking, goes, you know, mostly I live in third stage, but sometimes fourth stage. And I was like, well, what is that? And he goes, fourth stage, fully realized self, ability to attach and detach, to love and be loved, to not be guarded, to not be defensive, to not, like, and I went, oh my God, because he described how I wanted to be and I knew that I wasn't. And no one I really knew, I knew a handful of people like that. I said, yeah, that's what I want, to be fully open and fearless and love and be loved. And he said, oh, I said, how many people are like that? And he said, oh, nah, man, maybe 5%. Mm. And you know what I mean? So yeah. Our society just are not fully realized adults. We're not. When you look at our politics, good, bad, black, white, right, wrong, red team, blue team, that's all adolescence. It's all childish, mm-hmm. right? And so people are open. People are like, I'm trying to get there. I think I've gone backwards, but I know where I'm headed. Where and everybody should really try to figure out like this word attachment. It's the ability to love, but to not allow yourself to be destroyed by love, right? That when the person doesn't love you back, you're okay. It hurts a lot. You talk to your friends and you move on. You don't mm-hmm. chase them. Or if the person doesn't meet your needs, you're able to stand up and say, you know what, this isn't working out. I love you and I care about you. But these are important things in life, in work, in life, in with your family, with friends, to say that's unacceptable the way you treated me. I still love you. I'm not mad at you, but don't ever treat me like that again.
Right.
Right.
Bob, you're such an exceptional person. I really want people to know that even after the show, after Celebrity Rehab, I don't know if you remember this, but I went in and would see you and sometimes see Drew for months until I finally moved out of LA, but for no money, you know, it was just helpful to connect to someone. And again, even though I wasn't like the true word of like a substance abuser, I really was having a hard time.
I'm gonna give you a tip. Like me and Drew are both codependent. Why the hell would we be doing what we're doing? You know, you were labeled a love addict, but it's just codependency. It's this allowing other people to rule your emotional world, right? Mm-hmm. And so Drew and I knew, like, you'd leave after a session and be like, we got more in common with her than we want to admit.
Exactly. And that's why I think that after all these years, we're still close, even though we haven't spoken in so long. Yeah. I think we do understand each other, and I really appreciate you. Do you think that you and Drew will ever do something like a Celebrity Rehab again?
Yeah, we've been trying. I wanted to do it. Like, I don't know. It's a weird landscape television right now. What I'm disappointed in, every other show, like I have a lot of friends that had a lot of TV shows, and you can say to your kids, hey, go on YouTube, and the show is there. There's no Celebrity Rehab on YouTube for my kids to watch. VH1 holds it, or Viacom holds it and won't let it go.
I think it's on Amazon Prime. I've seen our season on Amazon Prime.
Have you?
But
you have to buy it.
It might be a recent thing. I think you do have to buy it. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't told my daughter yet because I don't know that I necessarily want her to see. But I don't know if you remember, like the final season, the final episode, you guys came all the way. Drew came and the crew came to New York City.
Yeah, New York City. I remember.
And
that was an after show, wasn't it? That was an after show.
But I think it's like episode 10 or 11 or whatever on
Amazon Prime. Went to the impact site.
We went to Ground Zero. You guys kind of helped me try to figure out a way to have some closure with that. That was, I mean, again, I really need people to understand what that was like. It was not just a show for me. It was real. And it was a way for me to say goodbye, have some closure. And, you know, to this day, have a relationship with you guys that I will forever treasure.
You were tough and tenacious. That was the beginning of the nastiness in our society where people were questioning you and whatever, but it was minimal. Imagine now. Where all this hate, like, I don't know that Celebrity Rehab, the things they said about Walt is like, I'm not a blue or red team, but the things they said about that poor little boy, the Minnesota governors.
About Gus?
Yeah, it's awful. Like, where do people get off?
I don't know, because I watched it live and I was like, oh my God, I was in tears watching how proud he was of his dad.
Yeah.
But like everyone else in the country, I did Google him while it was happening because I was like, wait a minute, is something off about him? Because I thought I just thought there might be something. And I knew the next day, I have a friend who's very MAGA. We are opposite. And I was like, how long is it going to take before your team starts saying, oh, this kid's a pussy. Oh, this kid's gay. Whatever they're going to say about it. Like clockwork, like 4 hours later was all over, you know, the news, like what's wrong with this kid. And it just shows you the different sides of people and the empathy that's missing or, you know, whatever. But anyways, I hope you guys bring celebrity rehab back.
But I want to get to the kid. I saw it that night. So before I worked for the addicts, I worked with autistic, high-functioning males, autistic people in my training years. I can spot it and people can't notice. I can also deny it. So, you know, when you work with autistic people for, I think it was about 3 or 4 years, you just know it. It's a beautiful thing, actually. They live in a world like the high functioning ones I did. It's just every day is a blessing. They're just excited to be alive. It's a weird thing. What I was on a spiritual path then, and I thought a lot of times all this stuff I'm trying to do to detach from wealth and possessions and whatever and just live in the moment. My friend Chris Kafer right here is doing it every day. It's a beautiful thing. So when I saw that kid, I was like, oh, you know, he's on the spectrum. I knew it just out of the side of my eye. I also know when they're not and their parents are labeling them that. You know, West LA, there's a lot of overdiagnosis of autism. I was like, no, he's just a little introverted. When he looks up, he makes eye contact with you. He attaches. He doesn't shy away from physical contact. Like, who diagnosed this kid? And I'm not going to say who, but it was a very famous person whose kid was diagnosed at an early age and it turned out it wasn't autism, came out later. I saw that kid when he was like 6 years old. I was like, that kid doesn't have autism. He's got something going on, but there's too many, you know, there was too much labeling of shy, introverted, maybe socially awkward, maybe delayed, learned kids being diagnosed autistic.
Right, or excuses made. Like if they're just a complete asshole, then their parents are like, oh, he has ADHD or triggered by this. Yeah. It's like, no, your kid's a dick. That's all.
Yeah, that old fashioned way is pretty good. Yeah. You know, I tell my kids, like, because I see them, you know, it's hard not to be entitled in our society because everyone's trying to act entitled. But for the most part, I blast them like my dad used to blast me. And people, if they're in the room, they're like, how can you talk to your kids like that? I said, trust me, it's good for them.
Right.
Because exactly. Everyone else is tiptoeing around them like they're precious snowflakes.
Right.
You know, there's a Chris Rock joke where he tells his daughters, like, you know, in this house, you're the most special people in the world. You're the most amazing and most beautiful, most intelligent. As soon as you walk out that door, nobody gives an F. That's how he sent his daughters out into New York City every day. And that's what I tell my kids.
That's amazing. All right. Well, if people that are listening to this want to hear more about you, what you do, if they want to get in touch with you for some help, tell them how they can find you.
Well, Don't Die Podcast. So I have an organization called Don't Die that it's been going on for about 10 years. I started it and it's got many chapters across the United States. It's about the opioid overdose death. It was a reaction to that. Just don't die. Just trying to get people to survive long enough to find the miracle of recovery. So Don't Die Podcast. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing one tonight. My podcast, I've been doing podcasts so long. My podcast partner died of cancer last year. And my 38-year-old son has replaced him on the podcast because he was a big fan. But, you know, you'll hear what I'm thinking, what's going on and, you know, a lot of stuff about this DNA as for addiction as a tool, right? You just want to talk to your kids. Nobody needs opioids unless they're dying of cancer. Is your 14-year-old son who broke his ankle dying of cancer? Then he doesn't need OxyContin. But that's my true message. But I'm using the DNA for addiction as a tool.
So where can people get one of these DNA for addiction boxes?
It's dnaforaddiction.com or .org, I think. I don't know. They should have the contact up, but we're just starting out. You know, it's just...
Is there a certain age that's too young?
No. I mean, I don't think you need to know. Like, I got a 3-year-old. I don't need to know yet. But when they get to be, you know, tweeners or, you know, when they're like your daughter, like at 11, the kids are starting to vape. You might want to use it as a tool right then.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to order it from you. And do it on Wyatt, because, by the way, it's just a great way to scare her into, you know, not doing anything and be like, Wyatt, you're predisposed to this, even if she's not. I'd like to know the answer. But I mean, I think it's great. I don't know why anyone wouldn't want to have that information.
As soon as I saw it, like most of the addict friends of mine are saying they want to take it, like Flea took it and other people like taking it. And I was like, why? Like, you know, these are 20 years sober people in AA. I'm like, what if it says you're not? Are you going to stop going to AA?
Right. Right.
Addicts are always trying to get a way out.
Exactly.
But it's more for your children. Figure it out and use it as a tool.
Got it. All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much. Also, tell them what your Instagram is, or is there a way that people-
Bob Forrest is a dad at whatever it is at Instagram. Bob Forrest is a dad. And somebody hacked it. I got to get on that to fix it. And I did go off online for a while. You're talking about, you know, I think I am, you know, misunderstood. I am what people think I am. And I'm also a lot more things, right? They think I'm some old hippie punk rock sage. Like, no, I'm can be an asshole. I'm, you know, I'm a curmudgeon. Like, I'm a lot of things. And when we label people to put them in a box that we can understand so we can move on to label the next person, I think that's why people are so misunderstood. When Celebrity Rehab came on, you know, most of the time I talk nonstop. I talk before I wake up in the morning is the joke. You know what I mean? Like, I talk. Drew is the one that's more measured and more, you know, kind of not guarded. He's just more... like how I'm portrayed on the TV show. Our roles are reversed. I'm the one talking and dealing with people all the time in real life, and he's the one more stoic and direct and kind of the authority figure, right? Mm-hmm. And but with TV editing, you can just make it seem like I sit there all day just and then finally say some wise thing, right?
All of a sudden, the sage has spoken.
Yeah, and so. But we are that. We're all that. People are complicated. People are really a lot of things. And we've become this labeling, simple society. Like, you know, when you were labeled, I was like, well, she's got to be more than that because she worked at the Wall Street Journal. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that's what motivated you, is being labeled this simple cartoon-like thing. And we do it to everybody. Yeah. Nobody's a cartoon. Nobody is.
And that's why I started this platform, because I do think it's so important to take a hold of your narrative. And even if you don't know what that is, like, make sure you figure it out and have a voice for yourself.
And
not get stuck in the what happened, but figure out how to change what's going forward. Because your future is in front of you. You can rewrite that story any morning that you wake up. But if you don't wake up, you can't rewrite that story. So
there you go.
That's what's important about just starting the day over tomorrow and being present in the now. But Bob, thank you so much. I hope it's not another 15 years before I see you.
No, I'll be around.
Yeah. And I'll next time I come to LA, I'm going to call you and Drew and we'll get together.
Yeah.
Session.
Well, he has a podcast too. What's going on there?
Okay. Yes, exactly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.